And you're listening to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley, also 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. Stay tuned for the morning mix.
Good morning, listeners. You are listening to KPFA's Morning Mix with your Wednesday host, the People's Minister of Information, JR of BlockReportRadio.com. Today we have a full show for you. We will be talking to Leroy Moore, the founder of the Crip Hop Nation. We will be talking to Cynthia McKinney about the recent arrest of Malcolm X's grandson, Malcolm Shabazz, as he was on his way to Iran. And we will talk to Wilson Riles about the new Oakland currency. Stay tuned.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with news headlines. Postmaster General Patrick Donahoe has announced Saturday mail delivery will end in August.
The new delivery schedule will result in about a $2 billion annual cost reduction, and it's an important part of our return to profitability and financial stability. Beginning the week of August 5th this year, the Postal Service delivery schedule will consist of 6 days of package delivery and 5 days of mail delivery.
Post offices that are now open on Saturdays will remain open. Today's announcement does not affect the post office plan to close post offices across the country. The Boy Scouts National Leadership has delayed a decision until May on whether to let local chapters include gays. Supporters of an inclusive policy had delivered 1.4 million signatures on a petition earlier this week. California Supreme Court justices expressed skepticism yesterday over claims that the state's medical marijuana laws prohibit local governments from banning storefront dispensaries. During oral arguments in a challenge to the city of Riverside's ban on medical marijuana dispensaries, several justices noted that neither the 1996 voter-approved Proposition 215 that legalized medical marijuana nor companion laws the legislature adopted in 2003 expressly state that cities and counties must accommodate retail marijuana dispensaries. Some 200 cities and counties have banned them. Christopher Martinez attended yesterday's California Supreme Court session.
The city of Riverside is trying to ban medical marijuana dispensaries. Lawyer J. David Nick argued the case for the dispensaries at a hearing of the state Supreme Court.
The issues before the court is whether a municipality may ban what state law has made lawful. And I think that that's the core issue.
California's voter-passed Proposition 215, the Compassionate Use Act, allows access to marijuana for medical purposes. But an ordinance passed by the city of Riverside bans medical marijuana dispensaries as public nuisances. Lawyer Jeffrey Dunn argued the case for the city of Riverside.
The focus here is, even in the absence of the federal prohibition, we do not have here state law preemption. The state does not command the municipalities to do something that we forbid in our bans.
Speaking after the hearing, lawyer David Nick said what's at stake is the future of California's medical marijuana law. Lanny Swerdlaw is the founder of the dispensary, the Inland Empire Patients Health and Wellness Center.
The people of California said that patients should have access to medicinal marijuana. They called upon the state to do some kind of program to attain the affordable distribution. And the only thing the state has come up with so far is this collective and cooperative distribution system, which cities and counties are trying to thwart what the state's done by saying, we don't like that, we can ban it under our zoning ordinances. And I guess what's going to be decided by the court is whether cities and counties can thwart what the state says.
The state Supreme Court will make its ruling sometime in the next 3 months. Reporting from the state Supreme Court hearing in San Francisco, I'm Christopher Martinez.
East Bay recycling workers asked Oakland city officials for help last night against what they say are abuses by the city's recycling contractor, Waste Management. The recycling workers and their union said Waste Management retaliated against the company's predominantly female immigrant workforce when the company implemented the E-Verify background check after workers announced plans for job actions to protest low wages. Three workers lost their jobs. Craig Merrilies is spokesperson for the International Longshore and Warehouse Union.
The work pays very little workers are making 40% less than recycling workers in San Jose and San Francisco. We're doing exactly the same work, in some cases employed by the same companies. This is not Arizona, and they can't treat workers, especially immigrant workers, disrespectfully.
Waste Management recently was cited by Cal OSHA for contributing to the death of a waste worker at the same Davis Street location in San Leandro where the recycling workers are employed. Maria Leon is one such worker. She was on hand last night to ask for support.
So it's so sad because it's, the family need the money and the work, you know, for everything, for the food, for rent, for everything.
KPFA will be seeking reaction from Waste Management when business offices open this morning. A left-wing Tunisian opposition leader was assassinated as he was leaving his home this morning. It was the first such high-profile killing since the uprising in Tunisia 2 years ago that overthrew the country's dictator and led to similar uprisings around the region. Tunisian President Moncef Marzouki cut short a visit to France. He criticized the killing of Chokri Belaid.
We reject this crime and we will unmask the enemies of the revolution. The process of democratization shall continue.
Belaid had been critical of Tunisia's leadership under the moderate Islamic and Ennahda party that dominates the government. He said it wasn't doing enough to stop violence by ultra-conservative Salafi groups that have targeted art exhibits and other cultural offerings. An opposition leader, Abd al Nasser al Weini, accused the government of being complicit in Belaid's assassination.
I accuse al Nahda Movement Party. It is al Nahda that has plotted for this assassination of Chokri Belaid. This is a defining day in the history of Tunisia, and we hold the government responsible.
Tunisian police fired tear gas at thousands of protesters who'd gathered in front of the Interior Ministry in the center of Tunis, accusing the government of allowing the assassination to happen. Ferries set sail for Greek islands for the first time in a week after the government invoked emergency powers to force strikers back to work. Thousands of demonstrators converged on the country's largest port to protest the order. They had been striking over long delays in being paid and other austerity measures. The strike had left dozens of islands with dwindling supplies of food and other supplies. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, partly cloudy this morning, then sunny and breezy with highs in the upper 50s. Rain is in the forecast for tomorrow. In Fresno in the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny and breezy, highs 58 to 63 degrees. You can hear expanded versions of our local news reports at PacificaEveningNews.org. I'm Eileen Alfandary. I'll have more news at 10 on Letters and Politics. Please join us at 6 for the Pacifica Evening News.
We are back. This is the Morning Mix. I am your Wednesday host, the Minister of Information, JR. We have a full show. We will be talking to Leroy Moore a little bit later. We will also be talking to Cynthia McKinney. We have Wilson Riles coming up. And also we will be talking about the Galileo High School Football Hall of Fame 2012 inductee, Coach Hadari Murray, who has an event Friday, February 8th from 7 to 11 p.m. at the West Bay Conference Center, which is located at 1290 Fillmore Street in San Francisco. Again, that is February 8th from 7 to 11. Now it's time to get to business. It is 8:08 in the morning for all of you that are traveling to work. Our first guest on the Morning Mix is Wilson Riles. Wilson Riles is one of the architects of the new Oakland currency, as well as he is a veteran activist from the area. How are you, Mr. Wilson Riles?
Good, JR. Good to be here.
Can you tell the people the history behind this Oakland currency? What's the official name? Is it called the Oakland currency?
Well, it doesn't have an official name. The working name that we've been using is ACORN, which stands for Alternative Currency for Oakland Residents and Neighbors. So it also harkens back to the fact that acorns from the oak tree were a staple diet of the Ohlone people, who were the first people here. So we're talking about a currency that is going to undergird the whole economics of this community. So that's why we stuck with the name Acorn so far.
Well, what is the history behind currencies? Before we get into Oakland's currency, when we did like a pre-interview, you were telling me about the history of local currencies. Why do people choose local currencies, and what has the history been throughout California and throughout the nation in the past?
Well, let me start a little bit with the world. There have been multiple currencies in a lot of jurisdictions throughout the history of the world. Most jurisdictions that have been strong economically have actually had more than one currency. One currency which benefited the people who lived in the area, and another currency which was for trade, and then the kings and the empires used this other currency in order to mass wealth to pay for armies and in order to go out and take care of other stuff. So what has happened is as those imperial forces have gotten stronger, they've squashed the local currencies that benefit the local communities and have forced them to deal with this larger currency, which has not been beneficial for them. It's been harmful for them. So when the United States was started, a number of states had their own currencies within the United States, and there was a big debate between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson about what the U.S. ought to do around currency. Jefferson lost that argument. Hamilton won. He started using the same nature of currency that was used in Imperial Britain and used it in order to amass an army that they used in order to take the lands from the Native Americans. But there's always been a right within the United States for local communities and local people to develop their own means of exchange. And that has happened repeatedly. Whenever this country has gotten into any kind of economic crisis, they have turned to local currencies. That happened during the Great Depression, and every time there's been a crisis, including this current crisis, a lot of local currencies are springing up. So the reason is because they are very effective in helping to lift and keep stable and sustainable local economies and local communities.
Well, I just want to put this into a historical context. Because, you know, last year we witnessed the overthrow of the Libyan Jamahiriya, and we watched the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi. And one of the last things he did was declare that African and oil-producing nations changed their currency in which they were doing business, oil business, changed the currency from dollars to dinars, which will be pure gold. And you know, I'm sure it wasn't the only reason, but it was one of the primary reasons why the U.S. government killed Gaddafi illegally, invaded the sovereignty of his country, enslaved black Africans inside of the country. And, you know, the rest is history, and, you know, led to what's going on in Mali and North Africa. But can you speak to why is this local currency in Oakland beneficial to Oakland residents? How will local people benefit from this? Why should I use this currency that you guys are introducing instead of the dollars that I've been using?
So I'll start with the macro level. In 2007, the city of Oakland did a study on where Oakland residents who were earning money were spending their money. And they discovered that about $1 billion of purchases from Oakland residents were purchased outside of the city. $1 billion a year. Hmm. So if those monies were spent within the community of Oakland, there would be more successful small businesses. There'd be more jobs. There would be more affluence within our community. So the dollars are leaking out of the community, and the way that the currency and the economic structure with the centralized banking is they're dragging money out of local communities in so many ways. If we can keep more of that in our communities, we would be benefited. So that's what the local currency will do in Oakland. It will create a lot of the resources that we earn and that we pay and that we give to one another circulating in Oakland. It won't go outside of Oakland, and that will lift the whole economy. But we're also structuring in to the local currency immediate incentives for individuals to participate in the local currency. For example, all of the businesses that we accept local currency, we're requiring them to give some discount when the local currency is used to purchase something rather than the U.S. dollar. And so that incentivizes people to move their dollars into local currency so they can get that discount on local sales. And then those businesses that participate, when those dollars are changed for local currency, then the entity that does that exchange will have U.S. dollars. And then they will make those U.S. dollars available to those businesses for no interest, you know, at cost loans, where they can't even get a loan now because the banks do not easily lend to small businesses, particularly young entrepreneurs. So we can also target this to young people, to people who want to start businesses, so that we begin to fill in the gaps that are in Oakland's business network so that we can serve ourselves and become more sustainable over the long run.
Is this a government service, or who will be administering this?
Well, the way we are designing it now is that it will be a part of what is a government-sanctioned local identification card. So already the city of Oakland has moved forward. They found a vendor, and they've sanctioned that vendor to produce a city identification card, and that will start being distributed next month. That identification card already has a debit card function on the back of it. There's a magnetic strip on the back of the ID card. It carries a debit card function, and there are immediate benefits for particularly the African-American community, which spends so much money processing through check cashing places. So there would be immediate benefit in terms of having some financial services on the debit card. But there's space on that magnetic strip, and in that space on that magnetic strip, that's where the local currency would function, in that space.
Now, when does this program start?
The debit card function is starting, as I said, in February when they distribute the ID card. We are now working out the details with that vendor. We tried to bring these issues up early and work them out with the council, but now we're going to have to work them out with the vendor. The city is still involved. The city stated in its legislation to create this card that they wanted the vendor to also, in a later phase, to add these kind of beneficial programs like local currency. We're very specific throughout the whole process of the legislation that local currency was on the table. Now we're going to sit down and practically put the pieces together. And what we're doing is we're merging. There's an Oakland Grown card, which incentivizes people to spend locally. The Oakland Grown people have already committed to move their card to the next phase of local currency. We're going to merge that with the ID card. So we're going through the process of working out the technicalities of that.
Now, you talked historically about where this comes from. Is there an example currently within the Bay Area or within California of cities using a local currency?
Yeah, there are a number of communities in California that have local currency. Davis has a local currency. In San Francisco, the one of the neighborhoods in San Francisco has a local currency. There's a community in Marin County that is actually minting coins for their local currency. There are more than 100 local currencies within the United States that are functioning. Ithaca, New York has had one for the longest period of time. Berkshire, Massachusetts, where W.B. Du Bois was born, also has a local currency that's very successful. They figure they have almost $2 million worth of bills circulating in terms of the Berkshires, and W.B. Du Bois is on one of the bills for the Berkshires. So it's very, you know, it's out there. It's been successful. There's no legal hurdles, and there's no practical hurdles to what we're intending to do, which is the electronic currency, which is the first time that local currency will be electronic when Oakland moves forward with it.
How do people sign up for the program? But before we ask that, for those of us that are scared of our privacy being invaded, why would I want to mesh all of this together on this card. I mean, we already have privacy issues with Obama. So why would we do this in light of looking at our civil liberties, our human rights being violated already? Why would we do this?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. Response is that there is no increased risk of loss of privacy with this program. The same level of privacy and security that you get with debit cards will also be there for this local currency. So all that will be affected. You will have a PIN. Once you get the ID card, you can decide whether you don't want to activate the debit card function or the local currency function. You don't have to. That's a choice that you can make. And when you do, there will be a PIN to control it, and you'll be able to manage your account. You know, if you have a smartphone or over the internet or over the telephone, you can manage your account, and you will get notices whenever any money moves out or into your account. So, you know, there won't be any increased risk of privacy around what we're doing. We're using the same essential secure lines and privacy that currently electronic money is being exchanged with.
How does people sign up if they would like to be a part of this?
Well, they can immediately sign up for the ID card. There's an office in 250 City Hall Plaza. There's also Spanish-speaking Unity Foundation has an office where you can go sign up. They will be opening up an office within a month at Eastmont Mall, and they'll also have a mobile truck that they're moving around. So if your church or your community group or something wants to schedule a time for a number of people to sign up, they'll be able to send a mobile unit by in order to do that. So they folks should get in touch with SF Global, which has an office at 250 City Hall Plaza. I would also ask folks, who have questions, they can email me. My email address is WRILES at pacbell.net, PACBELL.NET. You could also check out the website of the coalition that has designed this and is moving this forward, and that's at OaklandCityIDCard.org.
Now, are you guys planning to have any forums or anything like that?
Yeah, we will definitely be having forums. We'll be having town hall meetings. And when this is up and running, we'll have staff of folks who will go out and make presentations. They'll talk to businesses. They'll begin to build the currency network so that the currency flows and continues to flow, and then come up with a number of kind of additional functions, like finding young entrepreneurs, for example, making funds available for them to start their businesses in order to move forward to help to take care of themselves and their families.
How do people get in touch with you one more time?
Yeah, so my email address is WRILES, WRILES, at pacbell.net, PACBELL.NET.
Well, thank you, Mr. Riles, for coming on and keeping us informed as to what's going on in the city of Oakland. And hopefully you can inspire other cities to do the same to keep their local economies intact.
Richmond is just a few months behind us.
What's up. All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Riles. And for all of the Block Report listeners, you know, I want to just say happy Black History Month, although KPFA will not be honoring Black History Month this month due to the fact that they have a fund drive for 3 out of 4 weeks. I don't know. Why don't they split the fund drive with Women's Month and Black History Month? I don't know that they do this to any other group of people and disrespect any other group of people like this. Another thing that's disrespectful that I wanted to just put on the airwaves is that February 17th is the birthday of the late great Huey P. Newton, who is half of the founders of the Black Panther Party. Him and Bobby Seale founded the Black Panther Party in October of 1966. On that particular day, February 16th, KPFA will be honoring a white woman. You know, they will be honoring a white woman. Sasha Lilly of Against the Grain will be reading from her book. I don't know how that's being done in Black History Month, but It is. So what we're going to do is we're going to have a community meeting outside of her event. And I want to invite Wilson Riles and all of the guests today. But we're going to have a town hall meeting outside due to the fact that Andrew Phillips refuses. He's the general manager at KPFA. He refuses to address these issues dealing with the anti-black Jim Crow climate at KPFA. So what I want all of the listeners and people who appreciate the Block Report to do is to come to the event on February 17th, and we're going to have a meeting outside of the event on February 17th where Sasha Lilly will be speaking. Why did we pick Sasha Lilly? We picked Sasha Lilly because she is the former program director of KPFA, and in 2008, she was the number two person at the station when veteran broadcaster Nadra Foster was beat, lost her baby, had a paralyzed hand, and kicked between her legs and kicked in the head after another manager at KPFA lied and said that she was trespassing. So we're going to come on February 17th, and we're going to address Andrew Phillips and also Summer, the executive director of Pacifica. We're going to address them and ask them, why are you having this event during Black History Month? Why is Bob Baldock, who organizes for these events to happen, why is he not bringing black speakers during Black History Month? And why is KPFA not doing what the FCC mandates it to do, having community meetings so that the listeners can be heard, since you are the ones paying the bills? Another thing that I want to make a point in talking about Sasha Lilly is that on January 8th, if you go to the show Against the Grain, there were two F words that were dropped on some tape during Sasha Lilly's broadcast. Now, what's important about that is that we are risking, when anytime you drop the F word, we are risking a $300,000 penalty by the FCC. So this woman is there. I haven't seen anything. She hasn't been punished. But when she was in power, and Youth Radio, which consists of, it's a nonprofit in downtown Oakland. It consists of a lot of black and brown youth. Me, Wesley, who's at the boards right now, Dev, Nora Barrows Friedman, a number of other people have come through Youth Radio. Youth Radio show was taken off the air. Off the air, not suspended, taken off the air forever by Sasha Lilly and her administration because she was the program director in 2008. But we see how, you know, there's a right way to do things, there's a wrong way to do things, and at KPFA, there's a white way to do things. So there's like three different categories, the right way, the wrong way, and the white way. So, you know, during Black History Month, I'm going to make sure that we have things that make you say, you know, we're going to talk about a lot of these different issues. And we want you to share your commentary with Andrew Phillips. I have a few more bombs that I'm going to end up dropping, but we want you to share your commentary directly with Andrew Phillips. You can also copy me on email if you would like. My email is blockreportradio@gmail.com. Andrew's is andrew@kpfa.com. Also, you can hit Andrew on the phone at 510-848-6767, extension 203. 510-848-6767, extension 203. I want you guys to call them, but also email so that I have a record of what the listeners who pay the bills, what they want at this station, and we have a record that black listeners, as well as our allies who are listening, are not with this Jim Crow thing. Now, a problem that I have with the fund drive is the fact that my show in particular, the Wednesday edition of the Morning Mix, we've raised close to like $40,000 in the last year and a half. Our show hasn't been given a penny of support. Everything comes out of my pocket to get here in the morning. I don't have a car. Catch the BART, catch the bus. Not a dollar out of that $40,000 was given to me or to anybody else that's a part of the unpaid staff. We are being used as chattel slavery to prop up the paid staff in their mediocre broadcasting. Now, some people will say, well, why, JR, are you saying this on the air right now? Why didn't you try to come to some peaceful resolution? We've been trying to come to a peaceful resolution. I should say revolution, because that's what it's turning into. We've been doing this for over 2 months. I've been trying to meet with the executive director of Pacifica, who's been blowing me off. We've met with Andrew about an issue dealing with Michael Yoshida, the head engineer of KPFA. Michael Yoshida, on the day after Black Media Appreciation Day, which was November 27th, or 28th, barged in a studio where I was recording a breaking interview about the Congo and the war that has claimed over 6 million lives in Africa, which isn't covered adequately by the news here or adequately by most of the shows besides Walter Turner and Hard Knock Radio. So we were getting ready to break the interview. I did not get a chance to ever air the interview because Michael Yoshida busted into the studio, cut off my guest, who was live on the air from Africa, and erased the interview because I was 5 minutes late coming out of the studio. Now, I tried to keep this kind of calm, and for 2 months, I wanted to meet with Andrew as well as have a sort of due process. Michael Yoshida, they put a soft ban on me at the station where you need codes to get into KPFA. All of my codes have been cut out. I don't have a code to get into the building. If it weren't for the Black broadcasters and our allies who have been moving more secretly and making sure that I have codes, because every time they realize, Michael Yoshida and Andrew Phillips, every time they realize that I have a code, they erase the code. And so a number of broadcasters have given me their codes so that I can get in, as well as has given me codes to the pre-record studios so that I can pre-record interviews. So that's going on at KPFA, as well as I know that Andrew Phillips, the general manager, got on here and lied about the three top Black women last year within 1 year at KPFA and Pacifica have either been let go, as in the case of LaVarne Williams at Pacifica, who her contract was not renewed, who fought for Black broadcasters. Carrie Core, who was the program director who left in April and is quoted as saying, KPFA is the most racist, sexist, classist place that she has ever worked in her life. And I mean, this woman is like in her 50s, so she can remember kind of like the Jim Crow era and stuff like this. But, you know, I mean, when I say apartheid radio and I say Jim Crow radio and pertaining to KPFA, this isn't like a tongue-in-cheek type of criticism. This is what is really going on. Now, the last person that I was going to mention was Veronica Faisant. She is an assistant to the manager right now. She does managerial work, but they claim that she's not a manager. And also, Andrew Phillips is planning to cut her hours during Black History Month and give them to the white show that comes on before us up front. I mean, that's what's going on Black History Month. And for people, you know, because Andrew's going to get up here and lie and give some kind of justification, what I want to tell people is you can contact me, blackreportradio@gmail.com, and we can talk about this. You can also call Veronica Faisant and talk to her personally. Her phone number is 510-848-6767. She is at extension 209 if you would like to talk to her to discuss, is this true? Also, last but not least, I need to bring up the point in dealing with Walter Turner, who was leading the Black broadcasters against Andrew Phillips's decision to cut off veteran broadcaster Emmett Powell, who has the only gospel show on KPFA. They took his they took 1 hour and gave it to the father figure show, which is headed by the white celebrity Adam Mansbach, as well as former KPFA Hard Knock Radio host Waylon Sutherland. Now, I know that, you know, a fatherhood show, that's a good show. But why did the hour have to be gentrified from black programming, which already doesn't have enough? So enough of the tirade, but we want you guys to call in 510-848-6767. Andrew's extension is 203. Veronica's extension is 209. JR is at blockreportradio@gmail.com. And Andrew is at andrew@kpfa.org. Also, I would like you to CC Summer, who is the executive director of Pacifica. She is located at summer@pacifica.org and demand that she has a meeting to discuss these anti-black policies that are going on, not just in the past at KPFA. I'm not talking about the 50s and 60s. I'm talking about in 2013. I'm talking about yesterday. I'm talking about today. I'm talking about tomorrow. So, you know, I want you guys to also know that there's a plan to preempt us 2 weeks from now and probably let Brian Edwards Tinker, their favorite golden boy, you know, be the preempt the morning mix and let him do the broadcasting for us, or they'll put on some BS so that they can make a lot of money instead of actually trying to culture and work with our audience. So right now, you know, I'm going to give away some tickets. We're going to change the traction a little bit. We're going to give away some tickets right now. But before, I want to say, radio is a human right, not a privilege. The manager, Andrew Phillips, walks around the station talking about being on the radio is a privilege. No, Andrew, it's a human right. If white people have access to the radio to teach what they think is important, to teach their culture and teach their history, you know, everyone else should also. The Native Americans should. The Asians should. The Latinos should. Black people should. I mean, Andrew, I don't know. Where exactly? Actually, I do know where you come from. You come from Australia, where there's also Jim Crow in dealing with the Aborigines. So I don't know why you would think this is a privilege when people are not even versed on the problems at the station. Radio is a human right, Andrew Phillips. Now, let's give away some tickets. If you would like to win some tickets to see Melanie Fiona February 14th on Valentine's Day, you can do that at 510-848-4425. She will be at the mezzanine at 8 p.m. If you would like to see Rakim, the godfather of hip-hop, he will be at 1015 Folsom on the 22nd of this month at 9 p.m. We have a pair of tickets. Also, if you would like to see Egyptian at New Caribbean City in Oakland on the 16th of this month, we have a pair of tickets. And we have two pair of tickets if you would like to see the very talented musician Kevin Choice, who will be at Yoshi's in Oakland February 28th at 8 p.m. The phone number to win the tickets is 510-848-4425, and we'll be coming back with our very next guest. Music, please. Our next guest is poet, activist, and founder of Crip Hop Nation, none other than the journalist and many other names, Leroy Moore. How are you?
Hey, JR, how you doing? Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for coming on. Well, before we get into your Crip Hop tour, which will be taking place throughout the Bay Area from February 14th to the 17th at a myriad of different venues, tell us a little bit about the Crip Hop Nation. How was it started? What is it? And what is its goals?
So Crip Hop Nation with a K, it started like about 4 or 5 years ago. It started right here in KPFA, matter of fact. And I was doing Pushing Limits back then, and we did a 3-part series on hip-hop and hip-hop artists with disabilities. So after that 3-part, I think it's a 3-part series, I decided that I wanted to do more. So I put out a MySpace page that was way back in the day with MySpace, and got a lot of people from across the country, across the world, that are disabled and that do hip-hop and other music. So decided to put out our first CD. That was about 3 years ago, a mixtape, Quip Hop Mixtape Volume 1. And we had people from the UK, Germany, Africa, all around the US. And also, Quip Hop is not only about music, it's about activism, and it's about really education. So we have standards of what we, want on our mixtapes, what we want in our collective. We want people that are really active and really want to talk, about the industry, about the community, about oppression, about their identity. So we, try to stay away from, artists that put down other artists or put down women or put down gays and lesbians. We really wanted to have an activist kind of music. So that's how Quip Hop started. And now we've been, together for like 5 years. We've been to the UK twice. We've been all over the US doing lectures, workshops, and now this tour.
Well, as stated in the press release, this tour that you have going on is in honor of Blind Joe. Who is Joe Capers, and what has his fingerprints been on in the Bay Area for those who may not recognize the name?
Yeah, Joe Capers, I want to make a shout out to Nairu Nelson. Nairu is the film director that's going to be doing the documentary about Joe Capers. But Blind Joe was a music engineer and a musician, back in the 80s in the Bay Area, and had his first accessible studio in Oakland, in the Oakland Hills. And he recorded, MC Hammer, 2020 Tony, and Vogue, most of the Bay Area hip-hop soul people back in those days. And he also did music. And because, why we're honoring him is that I think he never got his props, So because of that, me and Nairu got together, and now we're doing a documentary that we're still working on. But this tour is really, honoring his legacy in the Bay Area. And also, Nairu and I is asking the city of Oakland to have a Joe Capers Day. So hopefully that's going to happen, hopefully in August. So that's Joe Capers. And Quip Hop just wants to honor him. And so at these events, we're going to show a little clip of the upcoming documentary.
Leroy, can you tell us about some of the other performers that will be performing during the tour?
Yeah. Pizzo, Mad One. Pizzo lives in Boston, in Sacramento. He's a hip-hop artist, disabled. He ran for Senate back in Boston on his upcoming CD. It's called Vocal Taisi, and will be coming out soon. He's a really good friend of mine. So that's a Pizzo. Joe Ellen is from Oakland and Berkeley. She's a hard of hearing black poet, and she has her own book called Signs of Life, Past, Present, and Future. And she's a mother, and she's been hitting all the open mic scenes in Oakland, so check her out. E9 is a disabled queer woman of color musician, poet, writer, and activist. She's been performing in the Bay Area for the last 8 years, and she has her own band, and she'll be on the tour. And of course, Vivian T is a Bay Area-based poet, works for Poor Magazine, and advocate with the Homeless Action Center in Berkeley. And she's been doing hip-hop music in the UK and here in myself. So that's the lineup of the tour.
Last but not least, how can people get information on where you guys will be playing?
Yeah, you can go to Facebook, of course, and type in Quip Hop, and we have our event page. We're going to be at the East Side Arts Alliance. We're going to be at the Mental Health Consumer Concerns in Concord. We're going to be at the San Francisco Main Library, the Latino Room, and we're going to be at the Living Room Project in West Oakland. So, yeah, just go on, and you can go on Poor Magazine soon, because we're going to post it on Poor Magazine under my column, Crip Hop.
Well, Leroy, unfortunately, we are out of time. Last but not least, how do people find you online?
Yeah, you can drop me an email at Crip Hop Nation. That's Crip with a K, Crip Hop Nation at gmail.com. And yeah, please come out. I'd like to thank our venues, because I'm doing this on an SSI budget. So thank you for the venues that donated the venues, and thank you for the artists for coming up and believing in Crip Hop Nation.
Salute, Leroy.
Peace. Thank you.
You are still listening to The Morning Mix with the Minister of Information, JR. Our next guest is Terrell Muhammad of the San Francisco Golden State Giants. I'll let him describe it. Mr. Terrell, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, JR. Thank you for having me.
Tell the people a little bit about the San Francisco Golden State Giants. Who are they?
Well, the Golden State Giants is a minor league football team located in San Francisco. We have it ranges from 18 to 25 our players, and we basically are like a bridge to a lot of arena football teams, to the Sacramento Lions, so that players can have an opportunity to really kind of continue their sports throughout the collegiate, or playing at any college or anything of that nature.
You guys have an annual dinner. It's the first annual dinner. The Golden State Giants minor league football team is inviting people to the Galileo High School Football Hall of Fame 2012 inductee dinner for Coach Hadari Murray. Who is Coach Hadari Murray? He's in the studio right now, but we're going to have you tell us, who is Coach Hadari Murray?
Great question. So Coach Hadari Murray actually was the founder of the Golden State Giants after seeing a niche that needed to be filled for a lot of guys in San Francisco. He started the Golden State Giants, but he was just recently inducted into the Hall of Fame a couple months ago by the San Francisco Unified School District, Galileo High School. He's been coaching for over 20 years, but the reality is we have a lot of unsung heroes out of San Francisco, and he's been one of the leaders throughout the city. And this Hall of Fame dinner that we're having this Friday will award a lot of unsung heroes, like our recently inducted supervisor London Breed out of San Francisco, Maceo Houston, who was a San Francisco player who also played for the Chicago club. So it really is a event that will catapult a lot of unsung heroes out of the city.
Why do we need to honor our own?
Well, You know, it's not enough that we popularize a lot of the people or our students that have really get all the attention. I think there are a lot of unsung heroes that don't really get enough attention or encouragement or motivation or inspiration to help motivate a lot of our younger generation. And having the team, having the environment, having the camaraderie, it allows us to really inspire more than just one person. And Coach actually has allowed this to happen through the Golden State Giants. We've had over the last 3 years over 700 people actually come through our organization.
Well, we're running out of time, but I want to definitely thank you guys for coming through. Tell the people where you guys will be and when.
JR, we're going to be at the West Bay Conference Center on Friday, February the 8th, starting at 6:30. West Bay Conference Center is going to be at 1290 Fillmore Street in San Francisco. Cross Street is going to be Eddy Street.
So for all the sports fans out there, make sure you come support your local sports. I want to thank you, Terrell. Please hang around because we want to put y'all on Instagram. I know that the legendary coach is in the house. If y'all want to see what Hadari Murray looks like, we're going to put him on Instagram today. And hopefully all the sports fans can come out. Thank you guys for coming through, man.
Hey, JR, thanks for having us.
All right. Our next guest is Cynthia McKinney and Randy Short. Are you there?
I'm here.
Randy? No, Randy. Okay. Well, Miss Cynthia McKinney, recently we heard about the arrest of the grandson of Malcolm X, Malcolm Shabazz, in Miami a few days ago. Can you give the people as much information as you have on this situation? And can you tell the people a little bit about what was he en route to do?
Well, I can tell you what I know, and what I know is somewhat sketchy. Originally, I came to know young Malcolm several years ago, and that was actually through you. And I had a wonderful series of conversations with him and understood that this was a young man who really did want to become politically involved. And in fact, on more than one occasion, in more than one conversation, he told me that he wanted to be politically relevant. And he wanted to live up to what the grandson, what is expected of the grandson of Malcolm X. And so I invited him to become a part of the Dignity Delegation, and he was a part of the Dignity Delegation's trip, the second delegation that went to Libya. And in fact, this tremendous conference had probably close to 1,000 people in attendance from all over the continent, as well as
look and know that it is not our walk but the one who carries it.
As well as people from all over the African diaspora, including here, Canada, Latin America, and Europe. And the purpose of the conference was to examine the brain drain that was leaving the African continent and going to these other places. And the message of that conference was, if you cannot live in dignity where you are, there were many people who talked about them being attacked as they walked down the streets. I never will forget the image of the young man from Prague who lives in Prague, and he was attacked just, you know, by some young hooligans because his skin happened to be black. And the message of that conference was, if you can't live in dignity where you are, then come back to Africa and rebuild Africa, and the Libyan government was willing to sponsor that kind of movement. So young Malcolm was invited to address this body, and everyone was just enthralled with the idea, first of all, of Malcolm X's grandson, but also the possibilities that came from that in terms of what that would mean. I find it interesting that he later got to know one of the persons that you are trying to reach now, Randy Short, who also was on that trip and was also very active in a documentary that was done out of Tehran by a black woman, U.S. citizen, who happens to live over there. She came over here to do a documentary about what life is like for black people in the United States now, particularly now that we have a black man as our president. And so she went, she literally traveled around the country. She interviewed dozens of people, and one of those persons that she interviewed was young Malcolm. And Randy was acted as her producer in this video, which was played recently at a Hollywoodism conference. It's a conference that was held in Tehran.
The capital of Iran, Iran, for those who don't know.
Yes, in Iran, that looks at the impact of the Hollywood, the industry, on the way certain depictions of Muslims, depictions of black people, which is what Dr. Randy Short and Marzia were interested in, and what many of us who are in the listening audience this morning are interested in is these depictions. And I find it interesting, although I didn't see it, but I've received my boxes blowing up, my inbox, my email inbox is blowing up with people who are discussing some show. I guess it was an HBO show.
Wait, Cynthia, we only have like 2 minutes.
Okay, about the depiction of the Malcolm X, of Malcolm X's family as we come up on the anniversary of his assassination.
You're talking about the Betty and King film, the Betty and Coretta film that is currently being shown on television right now, and the slanderous film that the families, both families, have come out against.
Well, we're not surprised, given what that history would try to be rewritten in the image of those who have never been friendly to us. Now, there are lots of questions about where young Malcolm was at the time of his apprehension, what he is being held for. I've been told that contact has been made with his attorney and that he is still incarcerated. But at this point, I don't know, serves me well to actually say what I've been told, since I haven't been able to confirm any of it yet. But I've been told that he's still in custody and that bail had been set, but I need to know more information. Sorry.
Okay, well, don't worry. What we'll do is we're going to bring you back next week to talk longer once we get more information about what's going on with young Malcolm. Unfortunately, we're out of time, Miss Cynthia McKinney, but we will bring you back next week, no matter that we're having a fun drive. February 9th, 1330, Fillmore Street. We will be having a meeting to deal with what we're going to do on February 17th outside of the KPFA event that is located at 2286 Cedar Street in Berkeley. February 19th, we will be showing a film, and then we will be having a meeting about KPFA, Django, and what's next. That is February 9th at the Jazz Heritage Center, 1330 Fillmore Street, 6 p.m. in San Francisco. Also, listen, tonight we will be playing Black Media Appreciation Night on the air. Until next week, this is Wesley Burton on the boards and the Minister of Information, JR. We are signing off until next Wednesday. Thank you.
KPFA listeners, KPFA's Community Advisory Board, or the CAB, needs new members, people with a diversity of racial, ethnic, age, gender, and socioeconomic backgrounds. The CAB assesses the programming needs and preferences of people in KPFA's listening area and reports its findings to the local station board and management. To nominate somebody you know, or yourself, email the CAB at cab.kpfa@gmail.com to request a nomination form. You can also email us with any questions. Nominations must be received by 5 p.m. on March 18, 2013. New CAB members will then be selected by the local station board. Serving on the CAB or urging your friends and coworkers to do so is a great way to help your community and KPFA.